and alternative materials, such as 100% VOC-free green pipe. Information at 503-342-8244 or eco-plumber.com. This KBOO program is sponsored by the KBOO Foundation members. And
wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Reaction to some of my medications and stuff.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am Denise Morris, your host for this December 15th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll talk climate change, police work, neoliberalism, and commodity culture. We open the show with Old Mole Bill Resnick talking to Tom Athanasio, following his recent trip to Lima for the International Climate Change Conference. They discuss important negotiations on climate change that could make progress on whether affluent countries create a substantial fund for helping poor countries cope, as well as transition to clean energy. Movie Moles Fran Michel and Joe Clement review Charles Burnett's 1994 film, The Glass Shield. The Glass Shield follows the struggles of John Johnson, a rookie deputy in the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, the department's first black deputy. In the second half of our show, Tom Becker reads Ben Zellwin's web article, Neoliberalism is Alive and Well, Slashing Wages, Maximizing Profits. And just in time for Christmas, Bill Resnick and Todd Sloan discuss states of mind and desire, commodity culture, and other left critiques of consumerism. This is Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick.
Thanks. Thank you, Denise. Tom Athanasio, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Tom Athanasio founded the Eco Equity Institute that's affiliated with the Earth Island Institute. The Eco Equity Institute is committed to developing an international treaty such that all countries do their fair share to reduce global warming to manageable levels. In fact, the Eco Equity Institute developed what they call a greenhouse development rights framework. It helps countries and international policymakers calculate each country's obligations based on their wealth and their responsibility and several other factors, their responsibility in emitting greenhouse gases and imperiling the planet. And his next book will be called A New Deal for the Greenhouse Century. Tom, you were in Lima, Peru this last week observing the United Nations Conference on Climate Change. Tell us who was there, why, what happened, your evaluation of the agreement they came to. And did they decide to use the greenhouse development rights framework that you and other eco-equity folks developed? First, though, tell us why this conference was so important.
Well, the climate negotiations are really important, Bill, for one simple reason, which is that while they will not save us, we cannot save ourselves without them. The climate crisis is a global commons problem, and we have to solve it together. And so, you know, despite the fact that we don't have a functioning global government, and sometimes it seems like we don't even have a functioning national government, we have got to work together at the global level. And that's why these negotiations are so important and so tense and so deadlocked, because We are in a pretty bad situation. That said, Lima could have been a lot worse. We did not, you know, the commentary on Lima is all over the place. If you start browsing around and seeing what people are saying, I think on balance we have to say that Lima was a missed opportunity. We could have gone a lot further. On the other hand, it was not a catastrophe. We still have a chance of making a deal when the real deadline comes up in Paris 1 year from now. You know, Paris is the great redo. I mean, most of your listeners, or at least some of them, will remember 2009 and Copenhagen, which was going to deliver us a global treaty. Paris is the redo, and Lima was the last big preparatory meeting before Paris. And the issues, I guess the good news from my perspective is not the finance that didn't show up, not the adaptation and loss and damage that didn't get negotiated. The good news is that the equity issues are now front and center, and it's impossible after the last 3 days of the Lima negotiations to believe that that something isn't going to have to be done on finance, and hopefully the elites will come to the same conclusion. Can't be too optimistic about that, but at least we're still standing. And you know, it's a different situation than it used to be, Bill. The science is absolutely clear. If you're a science skeptic at this point, it's not because of any scientific ground for skepticism. It's because of a political affiliation. You know, you don't believe climate science. You don't believe in a woman's right to choose. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's a choice you make about what you're going to believe. And so the science is real. The science is terrifying. The impacts are everywhere. The weather systems are increasingly unstable, and we know it's going to get much, much worse. So the situation is evolving. I mean, you have negotiators who were previously negotiating countries that were previously taking intransigent positions, who are now, you know, like Brazil is in a terrible drought. You know, China is having, you know, really, really serious problems with its air quality and really needing to start phasing out coal. So the equity problem has got to be solved. But the old battle lines are falling apart, and that's what was so interesting about Lima,
right,
is that there's actual, real, fresh thinking in the corridors. It was an amazing thing to witness it.
Right. Every country in the world now, except maybe for Poland, I'm not quite sure if they're still trying desperately to protect their coal industry. But it seems to me every country in the world, including the Russians, have come on board at some level and agree that something has to be done and fairly soon. That seems to me the bright side of Lima.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, and I mean, of course, the high capacity countries, that is to say, the wealthy countries, the high responsibility countries, that is to say, the wealthy countries, are intent on minimizing their contributions to the cost of the transition. And so you get all kinds of arguments, all of which are half true, for why that should be the case. But, you know, again, it's a global commons problem, and you have to remember that global commons problems can be solved, but only if each party to the problem sees the others as doing their best to do their fair share. That's basically true of controlling overgrazing on a meadow, and it's true of controlling emissions in a single global atmospheric commons. And so what we have to do is start moving towards a situation in which countries see each other as doing or trying to do their fair share. And so, as you alluded to earlier in this conversation, that's what I spend a lot of my time working on the fair shares problem. And so for me, Lima was a very interesting meeting, not because we had a fantastic breakthrough, but because there was much more openness to life beyond the North-South firewall, much more interest in talking about new models of effort sharing, as we call it, and the new models of international support. You know, some very fascinating things happened in Lima that didn't get any airtime at all. For example, the Brazilians floated a trial balloon for a new financing mechanism, which essentially is a financing mechanism by which there is some sort of green quantitative easing, which allows governments to do what they always do when they face an emergency, which is print money, right? I mean, there are ways forward on this. I mean, that's the amazing thing that you have to remember. The technology is changing really fast. The price of solar photovoltaics are falling off a cliff. So if we could solve the political problems, are the real serious ones, then we can solve the economic problems, and then the technology problems will really suddenly become tractable.
Right. As in you know, I was thinking the way the U.S. is dealing with climate change, it's not dealing with it on a war footing. World War II was won because basically the U.S. printed money and put people to work and converted industry and all of the rest of it. Now the Congress and the others who are even dealing with climate change are seeing it just as a normal budgetary item in competition with some of the others. Let's get back to the internet. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Tom Anastasio, who was in Lima, Peru. His Eco Equity Institute that he was one of the founders of developed a methodology for dealing with the fair shares for each country of the world in reducing greenhouse gas emissions and otherwise dealing with climate change. Tom Anastasio, the Kyoto Agreement had one model of dealing with climate change, which was to set emission targets for all countries of the world and enforce and somehow be able to enforce them. That methodology was the U.S. had a very big role actually in destroying that, although it may not have been workable. Obama, in fact, suggested a different methodology, which was for each country of the world to submit a plan. And there were no enforcement mechanisms discussed at the time, and it's not clear how. But it seems to me that way of dealing with climate change internationally has now caught on. Why don't you discuss that? And also, what would be the enforcement devices even after countries developed a good-looking plan? You know, you can develop a good-looking constitution as well, as many totalitarian countries have, but how do you ensure that it's adhered to?
Well, let me make two points. First of all, Kyoto did not define targets for all countries. It only defined targets for the wealthy countries, the so-called Annex I countries that were listed in Annex I to the protocol. And that made it very, very easy for the carbon cartel, the fossil fuel industry and its flax to attack it. And they spent a fortune attacking it and vilifying it as unfair. And that was one of the reasons that it was politically neutered, stopped dead in its tracks. And that was 1997 when the Kyoto Protocol was passed. Then in the early parts of the 21st century, there was this huge boom of economic activity in China. And the thing you have to remember is the Chinese economic miracle lifted more people out of poverty than any other single event in the history of human civilization. It was a big deal. But the world has changed since 97, and given the fact that you had the fossil cartel opposing the idea of the Annex I countries having to go first, vilifying it, blah, 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 it was stopped. Then we went to Plan B in Copenhagen, which is widely seen as a catastrophic failure. At least one really good thing happened, which was that people faced up to the reality that there was no functioning global government, and that if we were going to move forward on this problem, it was going to have to be in a way that let and encouraged every country to move to do its fair share based on its national circumstances, as the jargon has it. And yes, it's voluntary, but let me say something about that. Canada agreed to a target that was not voluntary, that was supposedly legally binding under the Kyoto Protocol. And then after it had its tar sands boom, it just walked away from that target. What happened? What does it mean for something to be legally binding at an international level? Was the International Criminal Court going to throw the Prime Minister of Canada in prison? Nothing happened. There was nothing that could be done because there is no international government. The notion of legal bindingness in the new regime is based on national bindingness. The idea is that every country will put on the table what it's going to do, and then it will pass national legislation in its own parliament or its own Congress that binds it by its own laws to meet the target that it put on the table. Now, there are many, I'm not a legal scholar, but there are many people who say that that's in practice going to be a much stronger form of commitment than this imaginary international legal bindingness, which, again, think of Canada. Think of Canada just walking away. Nothing happened. So that's one point.